This is tape 2 of Goblinhood Satyricon. Copyright 1995 by James Diotti. Read by Goblinhood. This tape commences somewhere a few pages into chapter 11. What seemed like an eternity, the dying mouse made a sort of a sluggish, drunken beeline in the direction of a final showdown called Destiny. And when it got to me, it just stopped and waited, as if it had done all that it could do and was leaving the rest up to me, as if it was really sorry now about that little spot of bother in the bathroom a while back, that little misunderstanding, like a hapless, guilty child nailing up a brightly colored stocking in hopes that Santa Claus would fill it with mercy overnight, a child who promised to never ever do it again. A mouse who would never do anything ever again. Previously, I had always scooped them up in a paper grocery bag and tossed them in dumpsters, pretending to give them another chance or something, or just passing the buck, I guess. But that wouldn't work this time. Nor was it a question of what the goddamn fucking new tenants might have to deal with. It was the mouse. The mouse had clearly stopped wanting to be alive anymore. The mouse had bopped over because it really needed me now to end its suffering, and I tried to help, half-heartedly smushing it under the sewing machine, but I pulled my punch, oh Christ, without meaning to, and the mouse made a noise that I can't describe, and I had to kill it again, oh Christ, oh God, oh hang on, mouse, oh Jesus, I'm sorry, and this time I brained it as hard as I could, and it worked, oh mother. And I staggered away crying, wanting to throw up, hoping like hell that being dead doesn't hurt, and wishing that I could have done the past few seconds over again, and not fucked up this time. Since then, I haven't been able to kill anything, not even a cockroach. Slowly or otherwise, without trying to apologize, somehow, silently or otherwise, to the universe and to myself, somewhere in the clouded future, if mercy should so happen to pass me by. It's been suggested, and wisely, that none of us is actually looking for justice around here, if we're wise. What we really want and need is mercy, or what Kurt Vonnegut Jr. calls common decency, or even, if nothing else, a competent stroke of grace. But all we get for sure is the big deal of the day in the death lottery. No other guarantees. Just ask that poor mouse. 12. Yes, Lovecraft meant to be a decent enough chap, all right, but it can be deuced hard to do if you're full of rabid, half-baked racial theories and other poisonous balderdash and proud of it, and especially if everyone around you agrees with you. And it was the ignorant whims and whams and the stupid yapping off in public by so-called nativists like HPL that got so many immigration policies tightened up, that got so many borders closed to refugees so long ago, just before the Nazis decided to throw the biggest Holocaust on record. Stalin didn't go public with his efforts, which might have taken the cake. And to invite the whole fucking world. And the whole world came. 13. And I guess mercy can sometimes boil down to just being efficient about murder, as Otto Ohlendorf tried to maintain at his Nuremberg trial. A former leader of Einsatzgruppen, mobile death squads, who, by the way, had once been Gestapoed for daring to criticize Nazi racial policies, like an attack dog being brutally trained. Ohlendorf tried to explain to the court how humanitarian he felt about his poor men, who got sick of having to shoot helpless civilians down into mass graves. And he said something like, "I can't imagine anything worse for morale than shooting down unarmed populations day after day. I can't imagine anything worse than being those unarmed victims," pounced the prosecutor, in words to that effect. "Well, I can," quipped Ohlendorf, and went on talking blithely about slow starvation and about people who had to be killed one way or another, and about poor, traumatized, good little Nazi postmen who were only following orders after all. For what it's worth, he volunteered for Einsatzgruppen duty, probably to clear up his stained political record. Ohlendorf may have had some kind of a point there to a student of mercy about bullets versus starvation or other torture or whatever, though it probably wouldn't do to actually say so out loud. He might not even have been at Nuremberg had he not been caught trying to escape Germany in the company of one Heinrich Himmler, former Reichsfuhrer SS, evidently an impatient man and an asshole who threw up watching a Nazi special action or massacre for the first time. They were both captured in disguise and detained. But the story goes that Himmler got tired of waiting or didn't like the treatment he was receiving or something along those lines. Because he blew their cover by trying to throw his weight around to the tune of comments like, "Don't you know who I am? I'm Heinrich Himmler," and so on. But somebody must have convinced him that Heinrich Himmler wasn't the best of things to be just then, because he very quickly took poison and died. To explain, Himmler apparently thought that he'd made a deal with the Red Cross by trying to trade Jews for trucks or something, but he was mistaken. As for Ohlendorf, he'd wanted his day in court, a chance to justify the unvarnished activities of the SS to the rest of the world, and he got that chance in September of 1947. And they hanged Ohlendorf at Nuremberg, which was probably too good for him, but which was the best that even the Soviets could do with everybody watching and the whole world cleaning up after the party. 14. So maybe Lovecraft was no paradigm of ultimate evil, but he was no paragon of virtue either. Hardly anyone was back in those days. Nor have things changed all that much. After all, better a paraphiliac than a paranoid, according to Goblinhood, who happens to be both in a pedestrian sort of way, but who is also much better at making such fine distinctions than the average poor sick bastard. Meanwhile, here's why he says that. The paraphiliac might not actually hurt anyone, depending on the situation, as long as he or she gets his or her rocks off, whereas chances are that the paranoid actually will hurt someone, eventually, if it gets bad enough or if things go far enough. Anyway, I once daydreamed of writing a Lovecraftian novel myself, and of calling it, perhaps, The Case of H.P. Kaltenbrunner. This idea started when I was browsing through a book about World War II looking for atrocity photos to draw and paint from, and stumbling instead onto a photo of SS bigwig Ernst Kaltenbrunner, successor of Reinhard Heydrich, the so-called hangman of Poland. Maybe it was the angle or something of the three or four pictures that I've found of Kaltenbrunner that made him seem to me to bear a facial resemblance to the handful of pics that I've seen of H.P. Lovecraft, only a little older perhaps, which would fit my theory, because Ernst K. was hanged at Nuremberg about 10 years after H.P.L.'s death. Unfortunately, one big fly in this ointment is the indisputable and hard to get around fact that Lovecraft was actually historically 13 years older than the Nazi. But hey, I once tried to make this same kind of visual connection between a photo of Nancy Reagan and pictures of early Twilight Zone character actor Burgess Meredith. At best, of course, the story I wanted to write would have been Lovecraftian, only in a satirical sense, with its title derived from The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. The Lovecraft novel in which facial resemblance and mistaken identity play such an integral part. But my tale would certainly have been a far cry from the tradition of Cthulhu mythos pastiche engaged in by writers both before and after Lovecraft's death. H.P.L. had encouraged this practice, but would no doubt have looked upon my proposed yarn as an eldritch horror and a thing which should not be. And not very surprisingly, either. In my novel, Lovecraft would not actually have recanted his racist ideas, but would have only pretended to do so in order to throw everybody off the track. Then, after having cleverly faked his own death from cancer and other problems in the Jane Brown Memorial Hospital there in Providence, he would have managed to sneak over to the then-booming Third Reich, where he'd have assumed the role of an SS bureaucrat, perhaps after snuffing his actual look-alike, assuming that the real Kaltenbrunner had ever even existed, and would have eventually wound up at Nuremberg, recovering from a cerebral hemorrhage so that they could hang him, and denying his own scrawl so often that he'd become known as the man without a signature, and even that would have fitted my cheesy little scenario perfectly. Of course, HPL neither smoked nor drank, and Kaltenbrunner is often described chain-smoking looted French cigarettes and swilling looted Dubonnet, but that could have been easily explained. Working around death camps bred vices like that, as even the SS monsters struggled to ignore the smell of corruption and to wash the taste of enormity out of their so-called minds, while they created what Himmler called
a page in history which must never be written,
or words to that effect. Ironic words to associate with the single best documented massacre in world history up to that time, or even up to the present. But in the end, I eventually decided that my novel was also something which must never be written, in much the same way that Alexander might have quailed at the thought of saying something really nasty about Aristotle. And did Lovecraft even remotely deserve such castigation? He kept most of the racist crap out of his fiction, and there's not a particle of evidence to support the idea that his amateur writings or letters actually helped to change U.S. immigration policies. Nobody important listened to somebody like Lovecraft anyway. As for the ethnic sneers that did find their way into his stories, even as a not very enlightened child, I hadn't been able to take them very seriously, instead regarding them as sort of quaint. While desegregation was raging around me, both in Ohio and Mississippi, where I sometimes lived, HPL's attitudes simply gave me an indication of what things had used to be like. And Kaltenbrunner? What was he really like? Well, he's been called an ideological Nazi by his biographer, Peter R. Black. Another source has it that his associates called him Gorilla Kaltenbrunner, which admittedly doesn't sound much like HPL, though both men were described as tall and thin. But there exists a funny story about the gorilla, if one can actually call any of the antics of such bloodthirsty monsters funny, which shed some light on where he was at. It seems that late in the war, Allied intelligence sources had taken to scaring themselves like kids making up spook stories about the thing under the bed, with vague rumors of an impregnable Nazi fortress under a mountain or something. A fortress which didn't actually exist outside their imaginations. But when these reports got back to the Nazis, no doubt tortured out of some hapless spy, the SS started thinking about actually building such a fortress, or Festung, using slave labor and counterfeit English money. But of course, everything had to first be cleared with Der Führer, who was becoming more and more of a bête noire, even to his closest associates. Even internecine mortal rivals, Himmler and von Ribbentrop, shared one interesting characteristic. If Hitler so much as frowned at either of them, it said the frownee would have to leave the room and throw up. Not hard to see why, of course. The deranged dictator was suspicious of everyone, and increasingly erratic and unpredictable. If you started something, like the fortress scheme, and it worked out, then great, you might even get a medal. If it didn't work out, on the other hand, you might find yourself sans metal, trapped in some gloomy Gestapo cellar with a soldering iron up your ass, trying to answer questions about the plot. It was Kaltenbrunner who finally braved the lion's den to propose plans for the underground fortress, no doubt a handy thing to have lying around if you happen to be losing a world war. But would it have stood up to an atomic bomb? An interesting question, but moot in that dimension anyway. Now, it seems that Hitler and Kaltenbrunner were countrymen, having both originated in Austria, and were therefore special buddies of sorts. Hitler apparently forgot sometimes that he hated fellow Austrians, spineless, weak-willed Germans, and in fact, everybody in the whole fucking world. At any rate, when Kaltenbrunner came into the presence, he found the master of the master race playing with a miniature city of Linz, Austria, which he was planning to rebuild. Adolf was really good at destroying real cities and then redesigning miniature versions of them, and this renovation idea may have dated back to his grub war days in Vienna. Come to think of it, Kaltenbrunner would have probably had better luck proposing a miniature impregnable fortress. Anyway, the madcap mogul shared his visionary fun with his subordinate, and it can be presumed that they towered over Linz like Lovecraft's Cthulhu and Dagon, or, as their Japanese allies might have put it, like Godzilla and King Kong, during their ensuing conversation. Hitler, the only person in Germany by then who was unaware that the war was lost, seems to have been in a rare good mood that day, and with his eyes twinkling and references to problematical miracle weapons no doubt twinkling in his discourse, he evidently convinced the more practical SS chief that Germany was, in fact, winning the war after all, thus obviating the necessity for any kind of lavish defensive measures. In any case, the fortress idea was never even brought up, and Ernest K. left with a smile on his face and a song in his heart, Deutschland über alles, most likely. And what was Hitler thinking? Perhaps, as his brain fizzed and crackled with situational psychosis and emotional hydrophobia, he lingered on thoughts of miracle weapons that didn't, in fact, exist, just as he counted heavily upon armies that no longer existed, all of which could have been conveniently stored, like toys in a toy chest, in the impregnable submontane fortress, which wasn't going to exist now either. Or perhaps he doted upon the old German cowboy and Indian yarns about old Shatterhand, which had doubtless persuaded him that America, in the end, would actually admire his extermination policies, having sort of helped to inspire them in the first place. And even Stalin seems to have been afraid to have Hitler assassinated, fearing that Germany and America would team up after that, which might have been a valid concern, considering how many ex-Nazi rocket scientists the U.S. seems to have coddled after the war, the ones the Soviets didn't get anyway, let alone how many former SS pricks were recruited into intelligence circles on both sides of the Cold War. It's doubtful that Hitler could have been familiar with Lovecraft's work, although an armed forces paperback was circulating by then, thanks to good old Arkham House and its founders, August Derleth and Donald Wandre. But read Lovecraft's book by Richard A. Lupoff, Arkham House, 1985, for some really interesting counterpoint to all this. If Hitler had read H.P.L.'s stuff, he might have been impressed with the similarity of Nazi Germany to certain conditions described in Lovecraft's most famous tale, The Call of Cthulhu, but perhaps the stars were not yet right for such a conjunction. In any case, he probably would have banned and burned works by Lovecraft for not being racist enough, or just because it was the right thing to do. And yet, all the post-war fables of Hitler's survival should serve to remind us all of Alhazred's inexplicable couplet, "That is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange aeons even death may die." And this was shaping up to be a very strange aeon indeed. 15. "Indeed," mocked Bella Madonna, still smoking that stuff. "Well, I was still getting higher and higher from those first three hits. Had I actually spoken, or was she reading my mind again?" "Indeed," I responded blankly, wondering just how long I'd been out of it this time and just what I might have said for her to be replying to. "Indeed," she repeated, her eyes seeming, or pretending at any rate to seem, to be twinkling merrily at me through the holes in her mask. "He sounds like a master of hysterical overstatement." "He?" I gulped. What was she talking about? "With the exception of one I could name, no writer but Wilson made himself more absurd." "Wilson who?" I wondered, but not out loud, silently biding my time. "And yet," she mused, half seriously, "there is a sort of parallel between Lovecraft and Desaad. I sometimes wonder if both weren't secret agents of I-Corps." "I-Corps?" I gaped, totally confused now, though firmer ground seemed vaguely to be whirling wildly about my soggy little island of perception. "Interformation Corps," she explained. "Information and intelligence gatherers and disseminators among the continua." "Cops?" I wondered aloud. "More like educators, I think," she replied blandly, eyeing me with some curiosity. "I'm surprised you've never heard of them." Was all that I could manage. "They're the ones who discovered the arachnid dimension, where spiders became the dominant life form," she offered helpfully. "Indeed," was my somewhat guarded reply. She chuckled, half exasperated. "Oh dear, I do believe you're stoned, and it's all my fault." There was no contesting that, and it was becoming truer still by the moment. yet I couldn't. Yet I didn't want her to think that I couldn't handle it, so I manfully proceeded to try carving out a place for myself in the conversation that I now remembered we'd been having. "Desaad," I said. "Aye, there was a lad." "That's one way of putting it," she exclaimed, exploding into laughter until she actually wound up snorting coffee through her nose. It dripped from her mask. I ignored said little indiscretion, having done the same thing myself on occasion. Besides, I had more important matters to think about just then, such as just who was this woman. In many ways, Bella Madonna reminded me of myself. Too many ways, in fact. She almost frightened me with some of the subtle similarities between us, which is what had been so bothering me for the past however long it was that we'd been together. The mask, like a female goblin hood, and a renegade club of her own, she'd said, called, of all things, the Black Widows. Do spiders congregate? Perhaps intelligent spiders, assuming social interaction to be a function of intelligence. And were the dominant spiders of the arachnid dimension, for instance, supposed to be intelligent? Impossible, snorted the science of my home con. Their bodies would never grow large enough, logistically speaking, to support brains big enough to harbor intelligence. Well, intelligence now. Doesn't that beg just a few questions? And how often was home con science ever ultimately right about anything anyway? Besides, the differing condition and natural laws obtaining among the infinite variety of space-time continua had given rise to a maxim famous, supposedly, throughout most of the omniversal matrix, to wit, that nothing is impossible save the possibility of something being impossible. And even that wasn't a constant, except, of course, for wherever it was a constant, since it left possible countless parallel worlds where various things were impossible on each one, my own home con included. There was even rumored to be at least one empty, isolated, and basically non-existent continuum in which nothing whatsoever was possible. A nice place to visit, perhaps, if one could actually get there from here, and if one could also get back. "Penny candy for your thoughts?" She smiled sweetly, having cleaned the besnotted coffee from beneath her nose and apparently shrugged off any embarrassment in the face of my blank stare. She was offering me a bowl of M&Ms, as I forgot once again that she wouldn't have needed to buy my thoughts. "Thanks," I said gratefully, taking a handful and hoping I'd be able to keep them down, not having eaten anything but coffee since that disastrous egg cream or whatever it was so very long ago. Yet I no longer felt very nauseous, nor even particularly hungry, as I gobbled the colorful little candies which had, I now noticed, tiny white spiders instead of letters printed on them. "The arachnid dimension's major export," she deadpanned, but obviously having me on. I mean, would even intelligent spiders be exporting candy? Candy? It occurred to me, too late, to wonder if it was drugged, and if so, what exactly the drug would do. I have disastrous memory fragments of mixing quaaludes and acid once, long ago, in which... No, forget it. Oh well, the stuff tasted like chocolate. Besides, a fellow in thought she had to drug me. She wasn't that much of a telepath after all. Had to drug me? I was already so loaded I could barely stand up. I'd have pissed my pants long ago if I'd had to piss and if I'd been wearing any pants.
Pants?
Pants? It was true. I suddenly, finally noticed she'd somehow made away with my vomit street clothes and left me naked. When had that happened? And how long had she been watching the idle rise and fall of my penis as I sporadically focused on and then forgot about her oh-so-delectable ass? How long is long? She seemed to be asking in my mind as I saw her nipples erect themselves through the open leather jacket. She still wore her G-string, garter belt, stockings, and footwear, still kept her other treasures nominally covered up, very nominally, I remember, in the case of her gorgeous asshole, which was brown and hairy and had peeked at me from behind its facade of string when she bent over to change the music a while back. And yet, it seemed almost to be the same album. I thought I'd heard what sounded like Flo and Eddie singing about something called Venus Dementia. Was that real? Indeed, the brief sight, let alone the faint perfume of her anus, had been responsible for the very loftiest structure erected by my crotch so far, a veritable phallic Tower of Babel, which had exuded a pearly drop or two of pre-orgasmic semen before its inevitable collapse with the wandering of my mind. I'd barely noticed it at the time, but now the memory of it turned my face red. She sensed my distress. Distress? In any case, she changed the subject back to whatever it had earlier been, I guess, or back to something other than what it was, or so it seemed. Jassad practically swore by sodomy, she said, seemingly apropos of nothing whatsoever, as I covertly attempted to hide my equipment with my legs, hoping like hell that my own asshole wasn't showing now. Something, the candy, had quantum jump-started the dope, like a bold new level of seductive, though near paralytic, intoxication. It was all I could do to think, while my asshole intermittently twitched and flexed in sync with the throbbings and jerkings of my once again engorged prick. There was no hiding my current state of mind, but for politeness's sake I felt that I had to say something and that it should probably be about Desaad or about sodomy or about both, but all I could think of was a story I'd read called Particle Theory by Edward Bryant, in which a victim of prostate cancer had had his rectum turned into a sort of a particle beam accelerator tunnel so that a beam of radiation could be aimed directly at his prostate gland. What would Desaad have made of that? You have a really nice collection of ass. I mean, of Desaad. I finally gibbered. My face now as red as my pulsing cock was becoming. But she gracefully ignored my Freudian slip. If only I'd been wearing one. As it was, my carnal urges were an open book, and so, I guess, was my mind. I picked it up at a yard sale, she commented. They teach Desaad to school children around here, if there were any school children around here. Actually, there were a few, but it's too complicated to explain just now. How much of it have you read? I asked, not really sure whether I really wanted to know. I'm not from around here, she ruminated as if I hadn't spoken. None of us are. It's as if this continuum was created especially for refugees from elsewhere. When? What brought you here? I tried again, more successfully this time. Religious persecution, she replied judiciously. Or else maybe sexual persecution. The men where I come from wanted to cut women's clits off in the name of some asshole patriarchal god. It sounded like Yahweh wearing his Islamic hat. But she didn't look Islamic. And you? I faltered. Oh, I've still got mine, she beamed, stroking it through the little silk genital pouch. Her nipples were still looking as hard as my dick, and so were my nipples, but maybe she wouldn't notice it on me. Desaad? She suddenly remembered. I haven't read all that much. But I started on Juliet not too long ago, and I'm up to the part where that government minister, or whatever he is, has kidnapped this family, and... But I stopped listening there. It was all just too pat for me. I'd recently tried to read Juliet myself, mostly skipping everything but the porn, and I'd gotten as far as that same part, where Juliet's powerful friend buttfucks a hated enemy, the enemy's wife and their young daughter, one by one, while a professional headsman slowly cuts their heads off with a knife. At that point, I decided that I just couldn't stomach anymore. 16. And it was the books, I think, more than anything else, that so alarmed me about Bella Madonna. Her music, her books, her shelf even contained the same edition of Kafka's The Penal Colony collection that I always carried with me back home for good luck if I had to visit a doctor or a caseworker. And I would read Conversation with the Supplicant religiously while I waited in the waiting room, just to be on the safe side. Did she? We were similar kinds of people, to be sure. And wouldn't similar people read the same kinds of stuff? But she was a little too similar to my mind for coincidence, and yet, physically, Bella Madonna seemed younger than me, and where I was running to paunchiness and middle-aged flab, she just seemed kind of plush. I couldn't quite remember her face under the mask, but if it in any way resembled mine, I hadn't noticed. Still, I was thinking of Carl Jung's concept of the anima, the female side or counterpart of a man, or vice versa, if I understand it correctly. Had I run into mine by chance? And if so, could she be my opposite in other ways besides gender, such as, for instance, concerning my fetish for harmlessness. Or maybe it was simpler than that. Perhaps Bella Madonna, if that was really her name, had come from a parallel universe very close to mine, but one in which I'd been born a female. That would explain a lot, and I knew I would have run away to protect my clit, if I'd had a clit, and maybe she'd bailed out for good much earlier than I had, like, say, at whatever tender age it was that her clit was supposed to have been sliced off by men, or at the instigation of men who wanted her not to enjoy sex, thus helping to secure her as one man's sexual property, and who also wanted to prevent her as property from running away by inflicting a wound which would never, or so I've heard, entirely heal. But what really scared me most about Bella Madonna was her mask. And now I knew how all of Goblinhood's traumatized victims must have felt. The Black Widows sounded like a bunch of sexual cannibals. And for that matter, the arachnid dimension, that concept, sort of bothered me as well. Suppose now, that a guy like me had stupidly blundered onto the turf of a giant telepathic spider, an intelligent spider from some other dimension, which, through telepathy, could figure out exactly what kind of appearance and environment would best seduce me, lull me, and then, through mental projection, a toxic hallucinogen or some kind of telepathic hypnosis, cause me to imagine said appearance on its part with that optimal environment surrounding it. But that would imply that not even the adventure of Barbarossa had been real, and I simply wouldn't hear of that. Besides, what purpose could such a large spider possibly have had in making me so comfortable, in making everything so kosher? No, I really couldn't believe that Bella Madonna was in fact a spider, nor that she might actually want to eat me. She seemed a decent enough sort. Very decent, in fact. In fact, she was so fucking goddamn decent, so extraordinarily, unbelievably, so nice, yeah. Oh, yeah, oh, I'm coming. 17. 18. She smiled at me from between my legs, her face, her mask, spattered with jism, my cum dripping, mixed with her saliva from her ruby lips. I'd apparently just spaced out during the greatest blowjob of my life. I just couldn't watch it wilt on me again, she explained, mock apologetically, delicately touching the tip of her tongue to the small hole in my cock, making me wish I could come again. I mumbled dazedly at her. Come again? She inquired. Are you going to eat me now? I mumbled again, slowly regaining my breath and what was left of my poise, not really caring about her answer. I just did, she smirked, starting to squirm out of her G-string. And I was thinking that now it's your turn to eat me. XIX. The thing about de Sade was that I found him almost unreadable at best. I hadn't really thought of his work as pornography a while earlier, and for a very good reason. True porn exists just to get you off, while it's sort of hard to tell just what exactly de Sade thought he was trying to accomplish. His work followed a strange sort of pattern, page after page of explicit, but often flat, descriptions of sexual activity that gradually stopped meaning anything or having any impact at all on one's stunned, jaded senses, interspersed with long, involved diatribes spouted by one character or another while they, the survivors, rested between frenzied bouts of perverse sex, concerning various aspects of de Sade's philosophy. Usually this gibberish was about how good evil was, or and how bad society was with its pretensions of being good or something. But often, while cataloging the weird practices of various cultures from all over the world, de Sade came off as an anthropologist of sorts, an unpleasantly erudite one, of course. A strange case, de Sade. He epitomized the decadent aristocrat, and yet was said to have helped instigate the storming of the Bastille by haranguing the mob from the window of his cell, where he was in for sex crimes. He pioneered the codification of sexual violence, and yet was unable, as a revolutionary judge, to condemn even his own personal enemies to death, for which failure, states the legend, he almost lost his own head. He complained of painful orgasms due to thick semen, and yet seems to have spent his entire life stalking the wily orgasm as if his life depended upon coming painfully as often as he possibly could. Yet it's also been said that the divine Marquis gave up sex entirely after he started writing books in prison, supposedly because no real orgy could ever live up to the ones he created on paper, which sounds about right. Did he use blatant sex to attract a readership, like that evolutionarily talented spider in Sumatra that impersonates a bird dropping in order to attract insects, and was disseminating his philosophy de Sade's real goal? Or was all that other pseudo-profound crap just his excuse for writing about sex? For that matter, I once knew an artist who began drawing a series of obsessive, explicit figure studies based on the rawest kind of porn that turned out to be about the best life drawing that he'd ever done. He wound up having to write an entire quasi-pornographic novel for these pictures to illustrate, which was sort of intriguing because his taboo against writing anything more revealingly concrete than poetry was even stronger than his taboo against making art out of pornography. He, too, was an interesting case. 20. How does one go about trying to describe a phenomenon like the artist Raymond St. Cloud? What is there to say that might begin to explain the Janus-faced creature known to him as Smiley? And how about the dinosaur? Where does that fit in? First, I could point out that all of this happened long ago and far away, and that none of it was my fault. I was just an innocent bystander of the first water, barely even around, at worst an impartial observer, like Kafka's explorer in his masterpiece In the Penal Colony, or like, if I understand it correctly, an intelligence agent clandestinely absorbing information for the mythical-sounding organization known to some dimension hoppers as I-Corp. Of course, I knew St. Cloud, which is why I'm able to be writing this at all. In fact, I knew him about as closely as anyone could, due to his aforementioned graphic novel, or whatever it was supposed to be that he was trying to write. But I was only responsible for his actions as far as being a purely mechanical collaborator, just another innocent Nazi postman. St. Cloud wanted a typescript of his opus, tentatively entitled Labyrinth of Venereal Vestals, and I had access to a computer and printer via an art gallery where Goblin Hood and I were volunteers of long standing. So I was slowly typing his long-winded manuscript a few pages at a time, and as a result I came to know the author slash illustrator quite well. Even so, I knew that only through compelling necessity would Raymond have entrusted his revealing literary diatribe to anyone, suggesting that he must have wanted the typescript pretty badly. And mysteriously, I can't imagine him truly wanting to publish it. Just writing it had been a courageous act of heroism for him, not unlike cleaning the Augean stables by bare hands alone, which is pretty apt considering his theme, although such a view might amount to a defamation of mere horse shit. As revealing of St. Cloud as his book was, I doubt that a tenth of his deep, dark secrets were on display in it. This owing to the limited nature of said besmirched theme. After all, the sole motive for his writing was to justify and validate the existence of an epic series of exquisitely drawn and photorealistically explicit figure studies, all concentrating on heterosexual sodomy, that is, ass-fucking between men and women. And how much is there really to say about that? Evidently quite a bit from St. Cloud's perspective, for at the time this story takes place, I'd gotten to page 84 of his penciled manuscript, about 25 typed pages, maybe 35 or 40 book pages, allowing for a flexible illustration scheme. And yet, this story is really only an involved character study of St. Cloud, aimed at explaining, if possible, his weird schizophrenic taboos and inhibitions concerning his art, pornography, and the writing of books. Nothing really happens in this tale of St. Cloud, unless you want to count the end of the world as we know it. For it transpires that the period of my collegial acquaintance with the author under discussion coincides with an emotionally wrenching crisis in his life, an overnight apocalyptic catastrophe which saw the overthrow for St. Cloud of an entire way of life which had existed for him anyway for about a year and a half. And while it wasn't as action-packed as the average Schwarzenegger flick, the atmosphere surrounding this event was plenty enough fraught with nameless tension and gut-wrenching suspense to the eye of one who knew St. Cloud the way that I did. The funniest thing about this rib-tickling and world-shattering agon was the half-assed, languid timing associated with it. St. Cloud's world was destroyed for him in the matter of a minute by the signing into law of a document, or however such things are done. And yet the intrepid victim of this existential holocaust wasn't even aware of the deluge until a month later, due to his stubborn refusal to watch the news on TV or to keep up with current events at all, any more than he had to. I guess his tardy revelation was due also to his pathetically inadequate but nonchalantly acquired and maintained stockpile of a relatively unassuming consumer product, an over-the-counter panacea to which St. Cloud happened to be strongly addicted at the time that the product was outlawed. In fact, his entire perceptual universe had been molded by this stuff for so long that, though he was actually getting sick of taking it, he never thought twice about restocking his supply on the day, about a month after that portentous document signing or whatever, when he walked into his favorite relevant commercial outlet and discovered that his casually proposed purchase had been made illegal statewide, had in fact fallen victim to the mindless drug war through which America was then seeking to enslave and even to lobotomize itself. It goes without saying that St. Cloud's reaction to the apocryphal news of retroactive apocalypse was pungent in the extreme, but it was also complex and ambiguous, due also, I suppose, to that weird timing. For only a week or so earlier, while contemplating his upcoming visit to the store, he'd noted how little kick the stuff retained due to his increasing tolerance level for it, and how the increasingly stupendous dosages that he consumed mostly just served to amplify the product's distressing side effects. One reason I can discuss his frame of mind as the world got pulled out from under him is, of course, that I was very much privy to it as his typist. Be sure that this mind-blasting event received due attention at the time within the flexible format of his deranged and besotted scribblings. Then, too, as his typist, I'm allowed to discuss the situation publicly in recompense for my clerical services. That was the deal. I'd type his idiotic statement if he'd give me permission to feature him in a peculiar case study that I wanted to write concerning certain vaguely obscure elements, aspects, of the human condition. Needless to say, I had promised St. Cloud reasonable anonymity in this undertaking, and I dare say the poor bastard had little idea as to just how totally revealing his scuzzy little document was in the first place. As for the distressing side effects of St. Cloud's addiction, I'd been aware of them for some time from observing his behavior and had, in addition, observed the effects of his trying to kick the habit via cold turkey methods during the one other time that he'd temporarily run out of the stuff. I couldn't help wondering what a compulsory future of being condemned to those withdrawal symptoms would be like for an artist whose most basic activities depended so heavily on his continued substance abuse. In some cases, in fact, these activities depended on the drug for their very existence, a factor directly germane to the longevity of my not very lucrative typing career. For it was clearly manifest that the project of writing Labyrinth of Venereal Virgins was very decisively influenced by, if not derived entirely from, the increasingly manic and harebrained mental environment generated by the drug, a powerful stimulant, among other things. For that matter, the problematic series of racy illustrations which so embarrassed the hapless schizo that they mandated the writing of his book had, in their season, been conceived and executed in the throes of a phantasmagoric spasm during one of his wired and euphoric binges on the banned consumer item in question, the now forbidden nostrum, cum recreational drug, and downright sacramental host, which St. Cloud had nicknamed both Treasonal and Substance X. No, Substance D. Neither Treasonal nor Substance D was the actual name of the drug, any more than Raymond St. Cloud was the actual name of the artist whom I have in mind. But otherwise, this stuff is verbatim type gospel, with only the names changed to protect the innocent, if that word can be stretched to apply to a case like St. Cloud's. And yet, his pet pseudonyms for the once commonplace but now sadly long lost object of his addictive lust and devotion were pretty apt at that. The word Treasonal had been coined years before by Raymond during one of his sporadic and short-lived attempts to write fiction. In his stories, Treasonal was usually a key element, a catalyst for whatever could be said to have happened by the end of his barely coherent compositional frothings. Certainly no born storyteller, that eminent author and celebrated bon vivant, Raymond St. Cloud, often relied rather heavily on the use of such key elements and catalysts to further thicken the so-called plots of his only nominally narrative escapades. And this, I think, was probably in some way a function of St. Cloud's mind, if that's still the right word, because in truth, the would-be scribe saw both himself and everybody else as a cross between animated test tubes and rigidly programmed robots. A fairly common worldview, I believe, and one which had eventually been codified for St. Cloud and for everyone by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. in the brilliant novel Breakfast of Champions. In St. Cloud's experience, nothing was more conducive to mental and perceptual transcendence than some powerful mind-altering substance, and certainly such cerebral transformations were chiefly what St. Cloud's hopeless literary offerings were usually about, to the extent that they could be said to be about anything at all. But I don't want to convey the misleading impression that I held Raymond's work entirely in contempt. Very much on the contrary, I quite admired his intentions, which, by my standards, were of the very best. And if the confused and cranky brain children of his ideals, in the form of embarrassing and shameful quasi-literary coprolites, were usually ill-conceived and quite hard to read, I knew that he truly meant well, and that he was confounded and hampered only by his own ignorance, density, naivete, and total lack of any true writing skills, let alone style. But I just couldn't help admiring the poor hapless bugger as he trudged glumly around in bizarre circles and less recognizable figures of pointless peregrination amidst the myriad flora and occasional fauna to be found on any given day in that bucolic nature preserve dedicated to the growth and expansion of human thought and known chiefly within widely scattered, and these days none too prevalent, ivory towers as the field of letters, a field wherein St. Cloud occasionally and quite diffidently presumed to attempt the planting of some modest little weed patch of his own. But his thumb was anything but green, and his regularly scheduled harvest following such figuratively horticultural dabblings amounted to simply another pain in the ass for an idealistic dimwit whose fundament rejoiced in chronic pain to begin with. To wit, once his unreadable crap was committed to paper, St. Cloud was faced with a new dilemma, the pretty problem of whether to try publishing his material, unthinkable in some ways for the reclusive philosopher and, rather fortuitously, impossible anyway in the absence of a publisher, whether to shelve the disturbing and potentially humiliating evidence of his insanity, thus merely postponing the need to decide his work's fate, preferably until posterity came along and took it out of his hands, or whether, finally, to just burn the offending data after all and thus kill two birds with one stone, first ending the immediate conundrum and secondly discouraging any further such painfully documented imaginative excursions on his own part. Yet this last decisive alternative ran contrary to everything St. Cloud believed in, violating the only inviolate moral and ethical principle in St. Cloud's slapdash code of conduct, an article of faith by which he lived, the conviction that true freedom of expression outweighed in importance any transient and largely pedestrian considerations regarding any of the following: shyness, reticence, or modesty. The defensive support of complacent self-delusion. The question of appropriate subject matter for discussion in mixed company. Any combination of ill-advised social mores. The primacy of long ingrained and nigh superstitious social conditioning amounting to a quasi-primitive belief system governed by taboo. The slavish adherence to local custom, the nauseatingly putrid lip service rendered to municipal dictates and bylaws, the widespread tradition of political cover-up in high places, and or stiff-necked and hide-bound and conventionally and conveniently all-purpose protection in season of so-called national security, let alone as trivial a concern as bad taste. After all, as that eminent author and celebrated bon vivant, Gore Vidal, author of Myra Breckinridge, once wrote in his historical novel Empire, good taste is the enemy of truth. And it was truth that Raymond St. Cloud so passionately sought, embraced, and promoted, preferably truth in bold capitals, no doubt unimpeachably uppercase truth, in the form of some kind of Platonic ideal, the one true manifestation of truth. But St. Cloud upheld truth above all, in whatever magnitude it was to be found in, no matter how painful and unpleasant truth so often wound up turning out to be. Hence, in the cause of truth, St. Cloud was grudgingly willing to tolerate and otherwise put up with virtually any use and or nominal abuse of freedom of expression, however much he might deplore and choose to castigate the expression itself. Indeed, St. Cloud held that the poisonous foamings of Nazis, child molesters, and tabloid journalists more than justified and vindicated their existence by providing him with such delightfully gaudy and high-profile targets for his own dialectic vituperation. His view was that the more dangerous and unspeakable an idea was, the more formally documented and accessible that idea should be to anyone who might wish to argue with it. In any case, St. Cloud always preferred for his enemies to stay where he could at least keep an eye on them, if not actually find ways to mitigate their effects on the prevailing cultural ambience. The concept of mitigation was, to be sure, the very keystone of St. Cloud's shaky structure of logic in regards to this matter. He believed that knowledge is power, not that St. Cloud believed in power per se. Rather, he chose to look at power as a tragic calamity and to look at the pursuit of power for its own sake as a kind of mental illness, a species of virulent social disease. But even St. Cloud believed, sort of languidly, in self-preservation and hence viewed the pursuit of knowledge as power and as a catalyst for change in the light of a necessary evil. What's more, St. Cloud believed, perhaps rather ingenuously, that even the mere ungoverned proliferation of stupid ideas and diverse attitudes, viewpoints, and belief systems could check, by virtue of its monumental complexity, the growth and influence of really dangerous ideas and toxic quackery. And he further believed that, in fact, only an unbridled plethora of alternate concepts, encompassing nothing less than the entire spectrum and potential fecundity of human thought, an ever-expanding heritage of admittedly dubious knowledge regarding the human condition, available to everyone with or without a mind capable of expansion. Only this, reasoned St. Cloud, only this infinite tapestry of intellectual and ideological gibberish and balderdash, virtually mind-numbing in its sheer enormity, this alone, free thought, writ large, could ultimately prevent some particularly malignant and predatory ideas and or set of prejudices from seizing control of and holding sway over the impressionable collective consciousness of all humanity. A concrete example of the kind of intellectual tyranny so feared by St. Cloud would be the rapid gestation and epidemic contagion of Christianity in the Western world, a malady which spread like plague or like venereal disease in the wake of conquering armies bent on rapine. For millennia, given another few years, a malignant cancer which continues even now to fester and breed within the tortured flesh of its near moribund host. But then Christianity's propagandists are, as a group, past masters at book burnings, witch burnings, and unabashed inquisitions, ensuring that no competitive creeds, value systems, or even mere flights of fancy could ever grow pervasive enough to challenge Christian intellectual hegemony in the Western world. In any case, it was no accident that St. Cloud's idea of a really dangerous book was the Bible, which opens its myriad festivities by having humanity get punished forever for merely seeking to taste that conceptual cornucopia of a feast which Chef St. Cloud wished to see served up in generous portions to anyone past whatever age it realistically is up to which children actually require protection against harsh realities. Paradoxically, of course, while fearing, loathing, and despising the Bible subjectively, St. Cloud was obliged by his own heretical credo to passionately defend both the Bible's objective right to exist and even its positive value as a negative example and an endless source of diseased information. This in spite of the clear and present danger posed by a truly poisonous book whose rabid outlook had led to untold hundreds of thousands of pointless and sometimes torturous deaths and to the virtual self-inflicted lobotomy of Western thought. As further paradox, St. Cloud's attitude toward his own idea of anathemata, the Bible included, in some ways resembled the supposed attitude of the Vatican Library, rumored in some circles to harbor the world's greatest collection of blasphemous writings, one and of documents pertaining to Christian heresy. The phrase, "know your enemy," would probably provide insight into the underlying idea motivating this admittedly hypothetical practice. But the greatest paradox involved in all of this is the fact that Christianity's empire of thought has only been checked and mitigated by the manifest stupidity embodied in its own doctrines and dogmata. In this sense, the vicious persecution of Galileo, for instance, was the most powerful blow ever dealt to Christianity, a self-inflicted wound if ever one existed, and that, in itself, goes far toward validating St. Cloud's overall policy toward the practice of censorship. Thus, St. Cloud divided his time between ardently championing the cultivation of free thought and multicultural diversity on the one hand, and on the other hand, painfully and bitterly ignoring, to whatever extent possible, the vast and ubiquitous quagmire of ideas, concepts, and expressions which transgressed against his own ideas of good taste, political correctness, or even common decency. This quagmire comprised a formidable array of obnoxious customs, ridiculous manifestations of cultural orientation, absurd crotchets, asinine idiosyncrasies, irritating emblems of genetic or ethnic identity, stupid sayings and strange doings, which amounted, paradoxically enough, to practically everything around him. It's far easier to advocate freedom of expression than it is to live with the results of that freedom, particularly for someone like St. Cloud, who was, perhaps by nature, one of the least tolerant people on a very intolerant planet. But he was also pretty expert at defying his own nature. Basically, St. Cloud reasoned like this, that millions of harmlessly stupid ideas would normally outweigh, on the scales of public opinion, a small handful of dangerously clever, bad ideas, especially considering the average stupidity of public opinion. In Nazi Germany, for example, it wasn't the existence of Mein Kampf which led to the Third Reich and the horrors of the Nazi Holocaust. Instead, according to St. Cloud's guesstimation of history, the Nazis became a serious danger chiefly through their suppression of any conflicting thought. This atmosphere of dialectic occlusion both facilitated Hitler's seizure of power and laid the groundwork for a scenario in which only Hitler's book and others like it were allowed to exist. The state of affairs then obtaining among Hitler's hapless subjects frighteningly exemplified the extremes of thought control described by George Orwell in his classic dystopian epitome, 1984. And, from all accounts, the Stalinist Soviet Empire came even closer to embodying Orwell's exaggerated portrait of self-perpetuating tyranny fostered by the cynical manipulation of knowledge and the harsh and ruthless control, nay, creation of public opinion. But here again, St. Cloud's belief in knowledge as power is reinforced by historic example, for it only took one stray thought, the erstwhile Stalinist heresy of glasnost, to bring down the long entrenched colossus that was the Soviet Union, though I dare say the USSR's economic bankruptcy and increasing dependence on interaction with the West had something to do with the surprising turn of events circa the late 1980s. But things might have gone very differently without glasnost. And so St. Cloud's simple-minded viewpoint gloriously triumphed yet once again. St. Cloud's fanatical devotion to this first principle of his was certainly admirable and went a long way toward slightly mitigating the absurdity of his own ridiculous excuse for a writing style. Yet his respect for truth and for unhampered expression as truth's only reliable outlet was based on hard-earned knowledge derived from bitter personal experience. Like me, St. Cloud suffered from a complex of psychiatric handicaps, but unlike me, St. Cloud was one of the most psychotic people I've ever known. His mind played tricks on him, as a matter of course, hoodwinking him, blinding him to the obvious, capriciously editing his intake of perceptual data, and relentlessly occluding anything that it didn't want him to know about or that it wanted him to forget. And so the poor deranged bastard lived perpetually in a queasy sort of shadow realm, surrounded by half-assed screen memories, reinforced delusions, and cheering misconceptions designed to keep him, at all costs, from the presumed folly of self-recognition. It sometimes transpired, however, that St. Cloud's mind would somehow slip up, subconsciously, deliberately, and tip its hand by letting him pounce upon one of his spurious beliefs or notions. Then, tracing it back as far as possible, he could evaluate the damage to his mind caused by such unquestioned psychic disinformation and take steps after first confronting and accepting whatever ugly truth might have been obscured by said trips, by said tripe, to rectify the situation as best he could. In any case, only a few such startling revelations were enough to start St. Cloud's questioning of virtually everything and to launch him on a tireless quest for accurate knowledge and an endless search for unadorned truth. And yet, seeking the truth did not, in fact, make St. Cloud free, no matter how much plain truth the poor asshole managed to actually find. It so happened that St. Cloud's own upbringing during the murky era of the 1950s had left him not only psychotic, but also insufferably repressed and inhibited to the point where total self-effacement seemed the most sensible approach to things. And yet, as his researches into truth progressed, he resolved to break his senseless inhibitions down. He became a man with a mission who could let himself brook not the slightest interference, which arguably is sort of the opposite of being made free, but our boy wasn't thinking about that. And so, with the stakes at such improbable heights, and with himself armed only with grit, spunk, and pluck, and with the rather corny beliefs that honesty is the best policy and that the truth will out regardless, St. Cloud courageously undertook the greatest endeavor of his career, eventually unleashing upon an unwary world his most